Thanks for listening to Matt McLaughlin History. Become a subscriber to receive exclusive bonus episodes, ad-free listening, early access to all episodes, and special member-only events. Click on the link in the show notes or visit patreon.com/mmhistory.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
A Living History production.
This is the Living History Podcast, broadcasting live across the airwaves.
Hello and welcome to a very special episode of the podcast. We're not walking a battlefield so much today, but we're discovering a battlefield. We're digging one up. We're delving into the history of the Second World War to try and find out more about the famous blokes from Band of Brothers. And joining us to talk about it is a good mate. We've had him on the podcast before. It's Richard Osgood. Richard, thanks for joining us.
Hello, Matt. Good to hear you again.
Mate, it's a pretty auspicious day, I've got to say. Our relationship began many years ago digging on the battlefield of Messines, because, of course, you're an archaeologist, and this is That you obviously do with a great passion. And we our passions united many years ago on the battlefield of Messines. And you've just reminded me that today is actually the anniversary of the Battle of Messines in 1917. So
yeah.
Completely coincidental, but it's a auspicious day.
It was 2007. I mean, you think that's a long time ago, Matt. We've known each other ages, but yeah. Well, I mean, that was a fascinating project, and linked a lot of our shared passions, didn't it? For looking at the First World War sites and tracing those footsteps of the guys of the Australian Third Division. That was a good series of results, I think. And happy to be speaking to you on the anniversary of that date.
Mate, I've got to say, if the listeners look back and watch our documentary Lost in Flanders, they'll see both you and I in 2007. And mate, you haven't changed. I'm a grizzled old version of that 2007 self, but you haven't changed at all.
No, you're very kind, but I think age has certainly caught up with us. But it's strange to watch yourself on a television program and see the passing of the years, isn't it? But but it's always good to keep in touch and talk about these fascinating projects that you and I get involved with.
Well, I just love it, mate. And I said shared passion, and that's what it's all about, because we've had you on the podcast a couple of times. We talked about the bodies on, what was it, Rat Island?
A couple of weeks ago. There's a few more eroding out. So that's a site that keeps giving as well.
So these are
people
convicts
that would have become Australians. Yeah, that's right. These guys that were about to be Australians, but they died on the prison ships in moored outside the Portsmouth Naval Base and buried on this island called now by the locals Rat Island. And so, I suppose it's the early stages of your nation's inhabitants of the old convicts. But that's a fascinating site, and very different to the First World War stuff, but all part of the whole interest of archaeology and what you can find in the ground.
I don't want to go off on too much of a tangent, but the thing I love about history is how these small little moments in history can affect us even today. And so you're digging up the bones of people who would have become convicts and moved to Australia permanently. And imagine, because they died of disease, I assume, on those ships, they never came to Australia. And the difference, there's whole families that now never existed in Australia. And I was reading the other day about someone was saying that their father-in-law lived in a little house on the outskirts of London, which was destroyed by a bomb during the Blitz. And because of that, they had to relocate. And when they relocated, he met someone, married them, and then their whole family started. And just one bomb falling on that one house changed the course of so many lives. I mean, you must get, as an archaeologist, mate, you must get that every day when you stand out there and touch that history.
It's those sliding doors moments, isn't it? Just one slight change can change everything. I mean, we let's go back to Messines. You've got where we were digging at a place called Saint-Yvonne, which is just below the Messines Ridge. Well, you've got Winston Churchill, who's in the woods there. You've got Anthony Eden, another of the British prime ministers in the woods, and up on the ridgeline, Adolf Hitler. And you think, these guys, just a strange coincidence, a stray shell from either side's artillery could have changed the course of the later 20th, in the middle of 20th century. Yeah, really, really odd. And I saw your one of your Facebook posts the other day of finding a single piece of insignia at Gallipoli. And it's that touching the past, touching people, and then, you know, learning of it, just trying to, you can't get closer, can you? And you're immediately transported to those days in 1915 and trying to work out, oh, what happened to the bloke? Did he survive? Did he just lose a bit of uniform? Was he a casualty? You know, what was his family? What were his hopes, his lives? And I love that sort of really, the personal elements you can get from finding things in the ground. And that's what really excites me, because archaeology is just about people. And it's those close encounters you get from the physical traces that really thrill me. And it can be a prehistoric element, but First and Second World War, just the same. It's about people. And that's what excites me.
Well, when I touch those objects from the First or Second World War, mate, the thing that it reminds me that you can't help but think is the last person to touch this was the soldier that dropped it. How does it work when you're digging on an Iron Age fort and you come across centuries since someone touched it?
Thousands of years. The same. We do with this veteran project I'm running with the recovery of using archaeology to further their recovery post operational tours. We had a guy is with us on one of the very early ones. It was an Iron Age site, in fact, a feasting site. It's called Chisenbury Midden on the training area of Salisbury Plain in Wiltshire. And this guy, Rifleman Singh, and he'd found this piece of pot and it had fingerprints on it. And he's putting his fingers into these fingerprints. These are 2,700 years old, these fingerprints. He's put his own fingers in there. And he said he's got a direct connection with his ancestors just by touching these. And he meant, from an ancestral point of view, the use of the landscape, because Rifleman Singh was from India. He was briefly in the British Army. So it's not from a geographic point of view, the ancestry, but it's the use of the land. So it's his use of the land as a soldier, but 2,700 years ago, it was the use of the land as a farmer. And he viewed that as an ancestral link. And that was an incredible moment. It's just being able to, touch what had been touched before, but no one had done it for 2,700 years. But same from the First World War. When you're working at Gallipoli, you as a historian, you examine the battlefields, you look at the writings, you look at the film, all these sorts of different bits and pieces. But when you're finding stuff, that person knew exactly what it was like because they were there. So you are touching elements of the eyewitnesses of history. And it's good stuff. It's always good stuff.
Well, it's good stuff we're talking about today, mate, because we're not doing First World War or Iron Age forts or Rat Island. Band of Brothers. Now, forgive me, I don't want to sound cynical, but the idea that you would dig in a village in England that was briefly home to the men from Easy Company before D-Day, it doesn't seem like an Iron Age fort or even a Rat Island or a Roman villa. I mean, tell me about this. Why were you drawn year? You've done this several years in a row.
Yeah, I've done it a few times now. This is, a bit of a strange one, but I'd been wanting to... One of the things I do in the Ministry of Defence in the UK is we administer a thing called the Protection of Military Remains Act. So every crashed aeroplane is covered by law. You can't just metal detect it or dig it. You've got to get a licence from the MOD. For years, I'd wanted to excavate a couple of sites archaeologically to see what extra information you could get doing it like that. And one of the sites I'd sort of considered was a B-17, one of the big American bombers that had flown and crashed near this village of Oldbourn. And this plan actually came to nothing in the end. But the chap that was showing me around said, oh, I'll show you a small museum I've set up in a stately home nearby, a place called Littlecote House, which is a Tudor manor house. And it was dedicated, in fact, to the 101st Airborne. And I asked him why I did this. He said, well, because Easy Company was based just down the road in Oldbourn. And from my point of view, I was thinking, well, I wonder what you can get archaeologically using the same techniques you'd use for a Roman fort or a prehistoric burial mound, but looking at a 20th century perspective. And for me, it seemed to work as a good idea working alongside these veterans I mentioned before, doing archaeology as part of their recovery, because it's part of their tribal narrative, their own heritage, their own history, because they'll recognize the military kit. They'll probably have watched the television series, which has lasted remarkably well. I watched it recently and I think that's lasted well. I was trying to think also of a more famous Western Allied unit than Easy Company of the 101st. And I couldn't think of any. I thought maybe in Britain, 617 Squadron, the Dam Busters, maybe your Rats of Tobruk. I don't know, but it's a single entity. I couldn't think of one. So it's probably the
and
most
a small
famous.
Group as well.
Very small group, about. They're really well photographed. There's loads and loads of footage of these guys. They do the most incredible events. You think of D-Day, obviously, but then of course there's Bastogne, there's the Arnhem campaign, they go to the Eagle's Nest at the end. So they do everything from post 1944 onwards, and so they are a unit with a huge amount of history. And I just thought maybe we could see that there would be some archaeology left, because Oldbourne, this little village in Wiltshire, it was the longest they stayed together in any one place in the whole war. They were there for 9 months. So they were there, billeted, unit cohesion, forming themselves as a kind of a unit identity. They're doing a lot of training nearby, so maybe we were going to find bits connected with their training. And about where they basically forge themselves as Easy Company before they go in on D-Day. They do come back briefly after D-Day for a few weeks before the Arnhem campaign, and then that's it. They've left Wiltshire after that. So did they leave a trace in this football pitch, effectively? In the 9 months they were there. That was the mission.
Don't take this the wrong way, but I assume you needed permission to do this. And did your colleagues scoff a little bit that this wasn't like real archaeology?
Yeah, well, it's a good point. Yeah, we do need, you need all the kind of permission from that. Luckily, the football pitch was owned by the parish council, and they all seemed, relatively happy. I think they thought I'd bring a load of archaeologists, which would drink in their local pubs and eat the Chinese takeaway and spend a fair amount of money, which did happen.
They obviously know their archaeologists pretty well.
They've obviously watched Time Team and seen what goes on there. So we thought that would be a good thing. And I think they thought, we'll let them have a go. And Oldbourne is actually quite proud of its links to the 101st. It's got a little museum there, a heritage centre, which talks about its other famous things. They're very famous for making bells, actually. So there's a lot of collection of bells. There's a big feature on Doctor Who, the television series, because one of the episodes is filmed there, and there's some good prehistory. So I think they get a lot of visitors from America still post the television series, and they want to come and see where the guys from Easy Company lived. So I think they thought I was unlikely to find anything, but it was worth a go. So we did some geophysical survey, and actually there were traces of these huts, so it meant we had a good chance of finding something anyway.
And you've done this, so is it 3 years now you've done this?
Yeah, we've done 3 years on it. The first attempt was to try and find a particular hut. There's quite a famous photograph of one of the big names of Easy Company, a chap called Carwood Lipton, who was one of the sergeants. And if you've seen the TV series, he's one of the guys that plots against Sobel to try and get rid of the kind of very strict commands and make sure that Dick Winters, who eventually does command Easy Company, takes more of a controlling influence. And there's a picture of Lipton outside this hut in Oldbourne, and you can locate where this hut was because the hillside's still the same and the trees on the hills are still the same. So you can stand in the same position as that photographer with the hut in the kind of middle distance. And we thought, we could see where this one had existed in 1943, and thought we'd do some geophysics. And it was there that we thought we'd try the first of the excavation trenches. So first year was Easy Company, second year was Easy Company, and this year we've just tried to find where Fox Company was as well, and another little bit of Easy Company. There were numerous elements of the 506th that were in this particular area. There are lots of diaries, lots of photographs, and so we've got a good historic record to go with the archaeology. But the key thing for me is trying to find those traces of those particular soldiers through the objects.
And you did it in cooperation with Time Team this year.
We did,
TV series.
We did, yeah. So we've done it a couple of times now. So Time Team was this year, and that'll be in a program that will air later on in 2023. They've issued, I think, various day-by-day accounts that you can pick up on the internet at the moment on things like YouTube. And it was a good success. So what we tend to do is we take the turves off with a turf cutting machine and get down to the foundations of these huts. Assuming that they were still there, and the turf cutter revealed that yes, these foundations are there. They're different styles. Some are made of brick, which is probably where Fox Company were located. And Easy Company had concrete footings. These are Nissen huts. The famous semi-cylindrical corrugated iron shelters that you could put up in 3 hours. A decent team could put one of these up in about 3 hours. And that's where these guys were located. You had 16 of them in one of the huts, had what's called a pot-bellied stove in one of them to keep warm. I think it must have been quite an emotional experience being in one of these in winter in Wiltshire. It certainly was, even actually in spring, it was quite wet. And so, yeah, you read some of the accounts, they painted them in different colours, quite gaudy. And lived in them for 9 months whilst they were training in the hills and the fields nearby, prior to going off to D-Day. And I just think that must have been quite an extraordinary time for these people before this maelstrom of D-Day going in, because these guys go in before the beach landings, of course. They're in the very, very first waves before Utah and Omaha Beach and the American landings there, to make sure that they're taking out some of the German stronger positions and the gun emplacements that are going to be putting fire down on the landing beaches. So there must have been a very curious time of relative calm before they drop in what must have been hell, frankly.
Do we have accounts from the men of Easy Company in their own words describing what it was like to be in England? Because it must have been a solace, as you say, before the storm. And, you know, they've come from training in America and this is their first taste of Europe. It must have been an extraordinary culture shock to find themselves
absolutely
in this little pretty village in the Wiltshire countryside.
Yeah, you're quite right. And I think it must have been extraordinary. Some of these guys, before they maybe went to Georgia for Tocoa to do the basic jump training around Corrihee, it may well have been the first time they'd left their state, and then they suddenly find themselves in Britain. Well, they take the troop ship over from America to the UK. They arrive in Liverpool, and then they take various trains down at night time to get to Holborn. And a chap called David Kenyon Webster, who was an English major, he's a very bright academic private soldier, he refers to the fact that when they got up in the morning, they thought they'd arrived on a Hollywood film set, because you've got this bucolic village with Hollywood style fairy tale cottages with thatch roofs and things like that, and very quaint and absolutely impenetrable money. I don't know. I still can't understand British money pre-decimalization. So goodness knows what these American lads made of it. And you know, they're in a war zone, so they're seeing people who've had, you know, years of privation, and they're under rationing. And a lot of course, the British troops are away fighting elsewhere in other theatres. So it must have been a very curious thing to find yourself in this beautiful location, but knowing that the end point is going to be something really quite visceral. So a number of them do write about it, in fairly decent terms.
What do the local people think to have all these Yanks descending on their town, descending quite literally often from the sky?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it probably varied. I think there must have been the conflicts, and we've seen some quite fun cartoons of British people getting annoyed at the amount of Americans in the pub, so they can't get their own beer because the Americans are in the queue. I think there's certainly a lot of hearts and minds campaigns that the Americans ran pretty successfully. There were definitely some GI brides. There were quite a few kids that were born locally. Lieutenant Spears, who was in fact in Dog Company, he did join Easy Company. And one of the famous characters in the TV series, you may recall, he's the one that allegedly machine guns the prisoners when they capture a lot of Germans. He gets married in the local church in Holborn, and there are numerous others. There's another chap who's turns out his grandmother, she hooked up one of the American soldiers. He was a medic. He wasn't actually meant to go on D-Day, but he didn't want to miss the overall event. So he effectively stows away on one of the C-47s, the Dakotas, which was the one that Lieutenant Meehan, who commanded Easy Company, was on. And this thing shot down and crashes. They're all killed. And so his grandmother is left pregnant by this GI. And so he's got a grandfather who was a medic on Easy Company, but never met him. So I think that was probably a relatively common story. And the kids that we met, who are now, it's very strange because these kids that were running around blagging chewing gum off the Americans and things like that, they're now old men, of course. So we got old men coming to our excavation site and talking about the American presence. And where one of these guys had a little toy monkey, a cuddly monkey called Switzy the monkey. And his mom, how did he put it? It was quite delicate. He said his mother struck up a close personal friendship with one of the American officers.
Very close, from the sounds of it.
Very close friendship. Yeah. And this guy gives this kid's toy monkey a Screaming Eagle badge and an Airborne badge. And so you think, oh my goodness, these Easy Company badges that are probably worth a fortune. And he did say to me, I don't know what happened to this officer. And, you know, we did the research, and sadly the officer was very badly wounded in Carentan, which is one of the early engagements of Easy Company. And he's then medevaced initially to near Utah Beach, and then to Cambridge in the UK. And then his flight, he's flown back to the States because he's that badly wounded, but his flight crashes into the sea and he's killed. So he sort of dies of wounds, but it's quite a convoluted tale. But I think the Americans made a huge impact on the Brits. I mean, there's that classic line of the Americans were overpaid, oversexed, and over here, that the Brits used to refer to it. But, you know, these guys in sharp uniforms who haven't had, you know, they're very physically fit. They haven't had the privations and of rationing and all this sort of thing. But they're there fighting a common cause. I think they did probably make quite a big mark in Holborn. And since then, a lot of Americans have come back. A lot of the veterans did return to Holborn to visit their old haunts, and their families have come since. And there are still, believe it or not, Band of Brothers tours that come over from America to visit the main fighting places in Normandy and the Netherlands and places like that, but also to see the village where in many ways it all began in the sort of fighting perspective, which was Wiltshire.
It's fascinating to talk about those relationships between service people and the local people. And in my collection, I have a book, a bound book, which was from the Second World War, and it's designed for Americans to explain what life will be like in Australia. And it's a fascinating account. It's wonderful to get that perspective of Australia from a foreigner, not just from a foreigner, but from a foreign government. It talks about how much tea the Australians drink and virtually no coffee.
Is that right?
And they eat an extraordinary amount of lamb. And you know, so sheep in Australia aren't just for wool; they're also eaten by the local people, if you can believe that.
Goodness,
but it's a big PR exercise because, yes, as you say, hearts and minds. It was so essential, and I've seen posters. I think there's one in the Villers Bretonneux Museum in France, which shows a picture of an Australian with a slouch hat on, and it says, "This is an Aussie digger. He's a friend of America." You know, so
amazing.
It really was that hearts and minds. Perspective, the idea that it was a collaboration, we're all in it together against the nasty Germans. It was a really important part of the whole process.
Absolutely. And, you know, this sort of replication from the First World War, you know, you and I have talked about Messines on many an occasion. And, you know, I'm sure many of your listeners know that the Australian 3rd Division comes in slightly later to the war in the First World War. And they do their training for Messines on Salisbury Plain, you know, where I'm based. And this is a detonation of mines that Monash puts together as being part of Plumer's army, but Monash gets the training in so much detail that it's a huge success. But again, there is still the phenomenon for the Brits of you've got a huge arising of people from totally different culture in many ways arriving in your small village in Wiltshire. I mean, Tilshead, where I'm based, they had the Canadians, including with Winnie the Pooh, the mascot Winnipeg the Bear, genuinely. We had the New Zealand with the Maori Pioneer Corps, and of course the Australian 3rd Division. And there are numerous cartoons of Australians in a very similar light to the Americans in the Second World War, of, you know, the locals being told about, you know, Australians coming here and fighting for the same cause. So it is this thing of you've got to do your hearts and minds campaign and make it very clear both to the soldiers coming in but also to the locals that it is going to be a strange cultural experience, but you are fighting for the same cause. They certainly did that for Easy Company at Holborn. There was even a training film by the, I can't remember the name of the actor, but the actor is the guy that plays Rocky's trainer in the film Rocky, and he's the leading actor telling you about the how the Brits drink ridiculous beer and it's warm and all sorts of strange stuff like that. And they've got this game called darts and stuff like that, and it is really charming looking back on it, but you know, probably quite important. I know what my experience of it is, that when we put, certainly from veterans of a modern perspective, you know, British soldiers next to Australian soldiers next to American soldiers of recent campaigns together, there's a lot of humor, there's a lot of banter, but they all do seem to get on pretty well because they're all part of the same tribe, as in soldiers. I think the soldiering experience probably from at least those three nations is probably quite a similar experience.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Is there a pub in the town, Richard, where you know that Easy Company used to come in and have a beer at the end of the day?
Yeah, there is, and we certainly helped support that this year. There's two one there were I think there were five pubs when Easy Company were there in the 40s. There are two that survive, and one of them is the Crown, and that's the Other Anks pub. And if you go in there today, there are lots of photographs of the old veterans when they'd returned, people like Wild Bill Garnier and Babe Heffron when they came back. So there's them as young soldiers and photographs of them, you know, nowadays. In fact, if you watch Band of Brothers, Babe Heffron does make a little cameo appearance, which is quite sweet. You know, he's one of the liberated villages in Eindhoven. He's sitting there outside the pub, and it's one of the real members of Easy Company. So that's the Other Ranks pub, and then the officers tend to drink in the Blue Boar, which is up by the church. And again, it's quintessential.
Great name.
It's a great name. Great pub. Very pretty pub. You know, half timbered and looking out over the village green. The village green's super. It's got it's a 13th century church with Tudor icons in it. And we had a curiosity last time we dug there. Last year, because we had one of the Australian infantrymen who was on his recovery program, a guy called Scotchy, who had a Royal Australian Regiment. And he was out there. We were drinking in the Blue Boar, and he was chatting to his mum about it. And she said, "Did you know your grandmother used to live in Oldbourne in Wiltshire, if it's the same place?" And indeed it was. And sent a photograph over, and we found it was the house nearest to the church. So complete fluke. It was utter serendipity. We didn't know. But yeah, Scotchy, you know, emphasizing the closeness of the nations, even in coming back to dig with us. And that's a nice tangential thing we had. But it's always good to have. We've had this on most of our sites, have veterans of different nations working together. And of course, when we're working on the Band of Brothers project, having American veterans and servicemen and women is a great thing, because you can see how much it does mean to them, because it is an important part of their national military history. And when they're finding, I don't know, garand rounds that had been held by members of certainly the 506th Parachute Regiment, probably from where we were, by members of Easy Company, that's quite a rush, to be honest. And, you know, from a Brit, that's a rush, but from an American who's grown up watching the TV series Band of Brothers, that's really quite something.
And speaking of the TV series, you had some of the actors come out from time to time as well.
Yeah, we did. That's another really, really good thing. Your listeners may know that quite a few of the actors are Brits. In fact, most of them are Brits. So the guy that plays the Dick Winters is, Damon Lewis, very famous British actor, but lots of the others are British as well. So we had one of our stalwarts is a chap called Tim Matthews, who plays Penkala in the TV series. And Penkala is killed in the village of Foy in the Ardennes. He's hit with an 88mm round. So Tim comes along, and it usually brings some of the others. So Shane, who played Doc Rowe, he's been along, and we've had Rick Warden, who plays Harry Welsh, who's features very heavily in Carrington. He's come along, and it's great. It's lovely. And what's nice is to see my veterans who've grown up with the TV series being excited and getting all the autographs, and then, you know, seeing the actors being quite bemused because they're only playing at being soldiers, whereas my veterans have done it for real, so they know what it's really been like. And when you're making good finds at the same time, and the guys that played the actors in the Band of Brothers, they went to boot camp for ages, so they formed a really strong bond, and they do still meet up with one another and have reunions. They'll probably, I'm imagining, going over to be probably in Normandy as we speak, given that yesterday was the anniversary of D-Day. And so for them, it's quite a thrill to be able to see where their characters were. And they really do identify with the characters that they played in the TV series. And of course, none of Easy Company are alive anymore. So it's in many ways keeping the memory of those boys of 43 and 44 going, that keeps them and their excitement continuing, I think.
Well, it's brilliant, Richard. We should talk about the dig. What were you hoping to find, and what did you find?
Well, it's an interesting one. We were hoping to find any traces of those soldiers, both in terms of their training, their downtime, and hopefully maybe even finding some of the British stuff, because the site was used by the British Army before the Americans moved in 1943. And we were moderately successful in finding British stuff. You know, we're finding charges of 303 rounds and the odd bullet, the odd button, the sort of thing you find on the Western Front. In fact, you know, the GS, the General Service button, that sort of thing. But from an American perspective, over the 3 years, we've been astonishingly lucky. And we joke amongst the team that you could put together a mannequin completely covered in American militaria now that would represent a paratrooper. So I think the really exciting find, and we found lots of, you know, grand, they call them chargers, don't they? Grand chargers. No, they call them clips, don't they? Clips. Clips and bullets. We found lots of buttons. We found buckles that were on the boots made in Providence, Rhode Island. It's not like doing prehistory. It even tells you when the things are made. So Providence, Rhode Island, and as you know, all the bullets have got date stamps on them. So 1943, 44, made in Illinois and things like this, Springfield. So that's all fun. The really exciting things are when you're linking to the paratroopers themselves. So we found an emergency parachute pull, which is painted red. It's very, very definitely American. We found paracord. We found bits of parachute itself. We found a clicker. You remember the film The Longest Day? Actually, it is also in Band of Brothers, where they have this kind of strange kid's toy that just makes a clicking noise to identify yourself as an American soldier, and you reply with two clicks. Well, we found one of those made bizarrely by Acme, and I thought they only made things for Wile E. Coyote, actually. But so you got this clicking toy, and they were only issued to the Americans, to the 101st, down at a pottery airfield in Exeter on the morning when they're flying out, or the evening when they're flying out for D-Day. They weren't used again because it's a one-hit weapon, really, because the Germans then clearly know what they're for. So this is a D-Day item, and it's come back, I mean, just chucked away or dropped in a field in the sites where Easy Company lived. And then, again, linking to the people themselves, two dog tags, one of which was to a Richard Blake, and he was a 21-year-old who was – actually, no, he was a 20-year-old who was in Able Company, so one of the other companies of the 506th, and he drops in on D-Day, and then he, after that, goes to Arnhem, where he's badly wounded, and that's the end of his war. But he lives, you know, a good old life, and he died not that long ago. And then the second dog tag we found was, in fact, a member of Easy Company. It was a chap called Carl Fenstermaker, who is a Protestant. All this is written on his dog tag. It's got his blood type on there and all sorts of things. And he was one of the two pathfinders of Easy Company. So, again, he drops in even before the paratroopers drop in, before anyone else drops in. And he does D-Day, he does Market Garden, he drops into Bastogne. He's one of only 20 paratroopers to drop into Bastogne. And then he's used as the German translator, because he's a German speaker, he's Pennsylvania Deutsch, uses the German translator when they liberate Dachau, the concentration camp. And so, you know, he's done some just astonishing things. And I think from all the accounts that I've read about Fenstermaker, who is one of the names of Easy Company, it was the latter thing, it was the Dachau experience that did for him. Not necessarily his fighting experience, it's the, you know, man's inhumanity to man that he found in the concentration camp. And from what I've read, he was unable to hold a job down after the war and didn't, you know, live for a huge amount of years after it. And as a result, he's a sort of, you know, he's almost a representative of what we're trying to achieve doing this project of recovery and rehabilitation for our vets, just to enable them to have a pathway to speak about their experiences and to maybe avoid what Carl went through after the war. So that's a powerful thing.
It's an extraordinary story, and you would think that as a German speaker, he would be connected more viscerally to that experience, because he would be able to speak to the survivors of the concentration camp, where obviously for the other members there was a language barrier, which probably kept them at a bit of a distance.
Maybe one stage back, absolutely, yeah. So he had all that. We're finding these things connected with the Americans. We're finding, you know, some of the fun finds of the sort of spam tin keys and K-ration keys and I don't know, other stuff there. You drink Pepsi bottles. We found some stockings in one of the huts. So again, back to your Hearts and Minds campaign, maybe going particularly well. And just all the things about their life. I mean, rations and fighting elements. We found quite a bit of German ammunition as well, which is maybe a bit of a curiosity. Belted components from an MG-34 or 42 machine gun. Lots of German bullets. We found a fuse from mine, bits of German grenade, and that's because they're using German equipment which they've captured to test to see how effective this stuff is, what it sounds like, the effective radius of these things, and just learning about your enemy, which is sort of thing, I suppose, when you think about it logically, yeah, that's what you'd expect or hope that they would do. But they're doing this in Oldbourne as well, so we're finding all their training was probably pretty good. And in the fields all around us, we go into the fields nearby. A team goes out there and finds foxholes or OPs that the guys have dug in training for the battles that they're going to face. And so that's a very useful tool for us to see that they're doing training all around the area. They're firing bazookas. We have found a few of those, which is a bit more emotional than the normal small arms that you find. You have to treat them with a little bit, maybe more respect. And then you get carvings in the trees. And I know we've chatted before about finding Australian carvings from the 3rd Division where they trained, and you can trace the names of these people. And with the Australian records being so good and all online, you can find out exactly their service history as well. We haven't had quite the same success with the Americans, but we have had place names and initials left by guys that are American. And that's another nice touch, because again, it's that hands-on. You're putting your hand on exactly the same place where a GI was just before dropping on D-Day, and then you're putting yourself in their position. You know, what was going through their mind when they carved their name. Quite something.
It's that philosophy of soldiers to leave their mark, isn't it? When they're facing death, and not just death, they're facing the risk of being lost in combat and disappearing from the face of the earth. So they're desperate to leave their mark.
They do. Some of the things soldiers will always do, there's graffiti everywhere. You look at I suppose the film Gallipoli, when you see the carvings left by the French on the pyramids of Egypt, right? You know, there's certainly an element of truth in that. We've got English Civil War graffiti from the 17th century in fonts, and there's Viking graffiti in a Neolithic chamber tomb up in Orkney, and they will always do it. That's one of the things that soldiers always do. It's probably the polite thing that soldiers will always do that we can talk about comfortably. But
Have you been to the village of Noir in France, Richard, where the underground city, where this is an extraordinary one, where there were underground caves dug into the chalk, which had been used for centuries by the local people. But during the First World War, they were actually a tourist attraction, and they'd open up these caves and invite people to come and tour through them. And obviously the British officers, desperate to find healthy diversions for their troops when they weren't in the front line, did organize tours of the caves with platoons of soldiers. And the soldiers, using their indelible pencils, thousands of them wrote their names on the chalk walls. And because of the environment, it's been preserved. And now you can go into these small little chambers, smaller than the room I'm in now, the walls absolutely covered with the names and details of soldiers who served there. It's an extraordinary link with the First World War.
Yeah, absolutely. That is interesting. I think there's a fairly similar thing in Arras as well, isn't there, under the caves there. They've got writings. And we found when we were redeveloping the artillery centre at Lark Hill on Salisbury Plain, they found a load of practice trenches and tunnels used pretty close to where the Bustard trenches were, with the Australian 3rd Division used. And there were lots of names written in pencil there. And there was, in fact, an Australian BC winner who'd written his name on them as well. So I think, yes, you're quite right. It's those traces of people that are, I don't know, when you're doing First World War stuff, I find those incredibly moving when you're linked directly to people that experience those things that you and I are fascinated in, and they live through it. Quite incredible.
I'm going to come back to Easy Company now and be slightly controversial for a moment. I heard years ago about an archaeological event in Gallipoli where they didn't dig anything, but they just looked for surface finds. And after a large amount of money had been spent and a lot of time had been spent, they announced their finds, and they said, we found bullets, and we found food tins, and we found scraps of uniforms. And it's really a great success. And I heard someone say rather cynically, and I didn't agree with this, by the way, but I heard someone say rather cynically about it. What does that tell us? That they ate food, fired their weapons, and wore clothes. So I'm going to put that to you. I'm going to put that for the layman. They go, well, we knew that Easy Company were there and were firing their weapons and practicing jumping out of planes. So what does the experience of archaeology on that site at Oldbourne tell us about Easy Company?
I think it's a perfectly reasonable comment, actually. I think it's a very fair thing to say, because you're quite right. We're not changing the story of Easy Company one iota. We're not changing the story of the Second World War, of D-Day, or anything like that. But what we find. But what we are finding, from my perspective, is a real way of engaging participants. So you're getting a youthful generation. You've got all the local school kids coming up, and they're bowled over by what we're finding and linking to these Americans, and that's perpetuating the memory. So we're not changing the story, but we're continuing the story. We're making sure that story and the legacy of those men continues through their memory being perpetuated in many ways. I think, you know, it's great seeing photographs of the Americans and all their kit. But if you go into a museum, there's something quite powerful when you see relic quality or rusty elements of the real thing. dropped by the real individuals, or thrown away by the real individuals. So they're quite right. We're not changing anything. And yes, they did just eat food. I mean, I think there's some nice touches finding, you know, the Hearts and Minds campaign of there, a couple of female badges and the stockings and stuff like that. But you'd sort of expect that. So it is not changing the story at all. But it is those palpable traces and links to individual soldiers, things like Richard Blake or Carl Fenstermaker, that maybe would get lost in the noise of the whole thing of Band of Brothers. But these are individual people. They are particular soldiers. We are maybe pointing out that it wasn't just Easy Company in that field. So Blake wasn't Easy Company, and there are other units that were there. I don't think we're changing much by way of the history, but we are continuing the history, I think, is probably what the archaeology is giving us. It's continuing that memory. Plus, also for my veterans, they enjoy it, and it provides an incredible well-being experience. From their point of view, 10 days spent in the nice field, drinking good beer with friends, chatting away around a campfire, that provides an incredible experience. So maybe just the memories, unearthing the memories of those men of pushing 100 years ago is helping modern soldiers in their recovery journeys. And I think that's probably the really important thing about it all.
Yeah, I think it's a very noble cause, and I think keeping that history alive is very important. It's not enough. I talk about this all the time. People say, well, why do you go to a battlefield on a battlefield tour, for example? Can't you just read a book about it, or can't you just watch Band of Brothers and understand what went on? But as you and I well know, Richard, there's nothing like walking the ground and experiencing it firsthand. So I think it's very noble work. Where are the relics ending up? Are they on display?
They are. We keep telling the museum they're going to have to get a new building because, you know, the scene in Jaws where you're going to need a bigger boat, well, they're certainly going to need a bigger museum because we are filling it with rust gradually. They're on display in the Oldbourne Heritage Centre. So they are technically still owned by Wiltshire Museum, which is in Devizes, all the property of the Wiltshire Museum, but they're on permanent loan to the local village, which means anyone who comes to the village to trace the story of Easy Company, they can see the finds of our excavation and get in, you know, close proximity with the finds that link you directly to those days of the 1940s. And I think that's important that they stay as local as possible. I think that, you know, for whatever the subject, that it's all great having the British Museum with wonderful things in. But, you know, if you can have those wonderful things based locally, then I'm really keen that it does stay like that. And certainly in Oldbourne, you can still see all the finds that we've made, dog tags, clickers, bits of helmet, ammunition, all that sort of stuff, all still there.
I think it's brilliant, mate. I'm heading over to the UK next month, and I'll be making Oldbourne one of my destinations to go and check
brilliant.
Out. Hopefully, during the time I'm over there, hopefully you and I will get a chance. Well, we'll certainly get a chance to have many beers, but hopefully we'll
drink
get a chance.
Drink a 506 beer. There is such
yes,
a thing. We could do that.
Fantastic. And hopefully we'll get a chance to go out and get our hands a bit dirty and do some archaeology, because it's been too long, mate. It's been too
been
long
a while.
Since 2007.
Maybe I can get you out to Rat Island. That'd be good.
Oh, I love the sound of that, mate. That would make it for a great podcast. We'll do that for
okay.
sure.
Okay, let's think on that. Nice one.
Great stuff. Richard, always a pleasure to catch up, mate. And if you're listening to this, Richard's been on a couple of our other podcasts, Rat Island, the Bullacore dig on the First World War tank. We talked about that a year or two ago now, so look that one up. But it's great work you're doing, mate, and it's always such a great pleasure to speak with you. So thank you so much for joining us today.
Always a joy. Thanks, Matt. Good to speak.
Thanks for listening. Don't forget to subscribe and leave a review for the podcast, and visit livinghistorytv.com for more great history content.